Hello, and welcome to episode 159 of Speak Beastie for September 4th, 2022. I'm Jeff.
I'm Marjolaine.
I'm Shannon.
And I'm Amy. Yay, it's a new month. It's September.
Now, I thought I would ask just at the beginning here if Marjo and Amy wanted to, like, pre-assign Jeff and I something to fight about that's innocuous.
Now, wait just
we'll
a
just
minute.
We'll just let it happen naturally again.
Hold up. Wait a minute. Let me put some sense in it. We do not fight that much, do we?
We don't.
No,
do we
no.
have a thing? Do we?
No. But the last episode we worked together, it was so fun.
No, just the last episode.
We could just replace Battle of the Beasts and just have it be like face down between Jeff and Shannon every episode.
Yeah.
Just about some random subject, you know?
I played back the episode and I saw the memes that went up on socials and I said, did Shannon and I, like, did we legitimately, like, fight about it? I didn't think we did that much.
No. I think it was more Lizzie being like, what is happening?
Lizzie's like in the backseat of the car humming to herself, everything's fine. My parents aren't fighting at all.
I'm suspecting Lizzie to be behind the fight and be the one causing the fight.
Like the silent instigator.
Yeah, it was all Lizzie's
We love
fault.
Lizzie. Lizzie's great.
Yes.
It's funny.
And speaking of great, our Patreon supporter for this episode is Lucy O. Thank you so much for your support, Lucy.
Yay! Yeah! Thank you. Lucy O. I know that's just an abbreviation of her last name, but can we call her Lucy O? I like it.
Lucy
I like
O.
it.
Yeah, that's her new nickname. Lucy O.
And now a message from our sponsors. Hey you! Yes you! The magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind-the-scenes features. But wait, there's more. Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs Knees and How.
So, for the Phoenix Register this week, the first news is something that was very present on the internet 1 week ago. It's about Mads Mikkelsen commenting Depp might, in quotes, come back as Grindelwald.
Right.
So I guess we had to cover that because, of course, like we could expect a simple quote become 100 articles talking about Depp returns. Which is not the case.
That's clickbait, people.
Yes.
Don't fall for it.
So the context for this quote was Mads was at the Sarajevo Film Festival, where he received the honorary Heart of Sarajevo Award for his outstanding contribution for the art of film, as he should receive.
Yes.
So they did an event called Coffee With, and that's there that he talked about all of his career. So this quote is just a comment about his role in Secrets of Dumbledore. So I have the full quote, so because, yeah, you should not take things out of context.
Yeah.
So that's the full quote. So talking about the role, it was very intimidating, obviously. Well, no, the course has changed. He won the suit, the court case, so let's see what... Let's see if he comes back. He might. I'm a big fan of Johnny. I think he's an amazing actor. I think he did a fantastic job. Having said that, I could not copy it. There was no way I could just copy it because it's so much him. It would be creative suicide, so I had to come up with something else, something that was mine, and built a bridge between him and me. So yes, it was intimidating. His fans were very, very sweet, but they were also very stubborn. I didn't interact too much with them, but I could understand why they had their hearts broken. End of quote. So
how did this spur so many articles? I don't understand the internet.
It was a slow news day. There was nothing to talk about.
Yeah,
clearly.
Also, the words Johnny Depp are just these weird buzzwords now that if they are uttered by anybody who has any kind of journalist within earshot, they publish something and it goes viral.
Yeah, because most of the quotes, it was things that Mads already told about when he talked about reprising the role and the work he had to do to make the role his. So, yeah, all of it was already said in many interviews. Just the different part of it is, the suit, the court, the trial. So, yeah. We have to be clear. I think Mads has absolutely no idea what will happen for the rest of the franchise. And honestly, nobody knows, I think. Not even Warner Brothers, which is quite interesting that they look like they still don't know what to do with the franchise. So, yeah.
I think they just can't say anything about it because they can't even acknowledge that there's going to be more installments. I think it's more about that. If they say, yes, Johnny Depp can take the role back, or no, Johnny Depp will never get the role back, I think that kind of indirectly implies, yes, we are definitely doing at least one more movie, and legally they can't do that yet.
Yeah, that's right. What I was saying. It's not about Depp especially, but with just movie four, we have no confirmation, but no... Mm-hmm. Nothing is canceled, nothing is confirmed, so yeah, we don't know.
Can I ask a question?
No.
Okay, that was a mistake.
Here's
I'm
the
going
argument.
To ask
Here it.
It
goes.
Is anybody else, I know that we have, as a fandom, we have been on a real roller coaster of an emotional journey with this whole Johnny Depp situation in the context of this movie and just in general. Is anybody else just really tired of hearing the name Johnny Depp at this point?
Yes, I am.
I can't do this anymore. It's always something. It's never pleasant. You never know what to think about it. And even if you do, it feels like there's no positivity left in this person. It's always gonna be something. And I can't go through this again with him. I can't.
Right. If we can't keep switching who's going to be in the role. It's like you make a decision and stick with it. So,
and you know what?
Mads
outperformed Johnny Depp. I've said it before. I'll say it again. He did a better job. I know a lot of people, including me, freaked out when we heard Johnny Depp was being fired. I liked Johnny Depp's interpretation of the role. I liked Mads Mikkelsen's interpretation better. He's a better actor than Johnny Depp. I'll die on that hill all day long. So no, don't you dare take that part away from him and give it back.
I've said it before.
Yeah.
Say it again.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah,
I don't know why they didn't just think of that from the beginning.
True. Yeah. But anyway, I think, Mads Mikkelsen was just trying to not upset anyone. So,
yeah.
But
he's
just being very generous.
Yeah. I wish I had the video of the way he talked about Depp's fans because the way I think it was pretty hilarious that he called the fans sweet but stubborn.
Mm-hmm. Accurate.
Yeah, that's not the way.
Personally, I would watch a video of Mads Mikkelsen reading a takeout menu from his hotel room because that man's voice is ugh.
Yeah.
I'll listen to that.
But anyway, if you really want to hear some host talking about the trial and more specifically what will happen now, we have a bonus discussion on Patreon with Liz, and Amy. You were in it, so yeah. You can listen to that if you want to hear some a more in-depth discussion about this situation. But yeah, I agree with with Jeff, and my take is just that I don't want Depp back in the franchise for many reasons. And yeah, so that's all I have to say.
And we can leave it at that.
So, the next... we don't have a lot of news, to be honest. So, I... since I had the Phoenix Register to prepare, I think it would be fun to have the French corner of the Phoenix Register. Yes. Because, yes, the first big news in France is that Secrets of Dumbledore is now out in digital download DVD and Blu-ray. So, yay! We finally have the movie. So, yeah. And the other news is quite funny for me also, because around the same day of this release, Warner Brother launched a website called WizardingWorldVOD.com, and actually it's a website to help French people to find where we can buy or rent the Harry Potter and Fantastic Beasts movies, because obviously nobody knows where they are. Because and apparently even Warner Brother doesn't know when the movie are available in France, because they forgot to include Salto, which is the only French streaming service where we can find the Potter movies. So,
wow. Oops.
That's funny. So, yeah, because we don't have HBO Max in France. So they have
what?
To... No, we don't.
You
we
don't
barely have
HBO,
HBO
Why
Max
not?
Here now.
Because we don't have HBO Max in France. So, yeah, we have the HBO shows on a French streaming service. So they have link with French services, but we don't have HBO Max. So
okay,
yeah.
We need to start a petition immediately for France to get HBO Max access so that Marjolaine can have that.
I mean, I have mostly what they have on HBO Max, but on other services, the rights are spread out.
Yeah,
several streaming services.
But do you have House of the Dragon though?
Yes, like I said, we have the HBO TV shows. We have them on OCS, which is a service that I have. So yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll drop my petition then. I'm just saying, if you want HBO Max, let me know. I'll start a petition. I'll get France to do it. I don't know how, but I'll figure it out.
Yeah, probably one day, but. We see. So that's it for the Phoenix Register. Not much this past 2 weeks, but yeah.
Nice.
Fair enough, because the sun is shining, it's a beautiful day, and I think some owls are headed our way. A poem
you
for
keep
you.
Rhyming.
It did rhyme. I know how to do rhyming poetry, and I did it. So for episode 157, our podcast question was, do you like the behind-the-scenes moments in the finished screenplay, and would you rather see a published version of just the actual script? And we got a response on Instagram from Les Lectures de Poppy.
No,
did I
it's
do that?
Les Lectures de Poppy.
Oh, gosh, that's embarrassing.
Wow, it sounds different.
It's, oh, wow. Now I feel ignorant and that I have insulted this Instagram user, so I am so sorry about
that.
I
think it's French, so, yeah.
When it's all one word like that and it's mostly lowercase letters, it's hard for me to be sure. Okay, thank you for clearing that up. I appreciate that. So, this person on Instagram, whose name I have now butchered, says... I would love a real companion book, Mina Lima / Salisbury. And I like this one, but I hate it's not the same size or cover, but would prefer a script with everything that had been deleted. Same wish for all three movies. And when I saw that, I agreed. Yeah. Because if I can't see the kiss on camera, if they're not going to release the footage, I at least want to read about it, and I want them to acknowledge in something they've published that it happened.
I agree.
I am not kidding. I want the it almost like I sound like I'm mostly kidding, and I somewhat am, but at the same time it does kind of border on erasure for you to imply that something like that happened and then not even acknowledge it in a script.
I mean, I don't care about the kiss, but I would prefer a screenplay that has That was the actual shooting script. Yeah. I know you care.
Yeah.
I care. I don't know why I care, but I care. Yes, I ship those two gentlemen. That's probably part of it.
I kind of feel like that would have to be like one of the little extras, like what we have in this screenplay of like the behind the scenes quotes from people.
Mm-hmm.
Like saying, oh, in one of the takes of this scene, there was this impromptu kiss, because like I feel like it was unscripted, so I don't know if it would make it into
that's
the
true
screenplay.
If it wasn't in the script to begin with.
So it would have to be like one of those books like this where they like insert little things, or like this Instagram user is saying, like Amina Lima Salisbury, like behind the scenes stuff would be like cool, because you could have little things like that about the filming as well.
Yeah.
Okay, if you're telling me that Mads Mikkelsen improv that kiss and Jude Law's acting instincts were so good and open-minded that he just went with it, that would make me respect the two of them even more.
I would believe it, absolutely.
Yeah. Or like they talked about it between takes or something, or it's like, hey, like this time can we try this?
I could just imagine Jude Law's walking out of his trailer and Matt is just kind of hanging out by the door and he says, okay, hear me out. There's something I'd like to try out on you.
And
after
phrase.
He does his little pitch, Jude Law is just like, yeah, all right. It's like, it's probably not going to make it in the film anyway, but if it does, I'll just call my wife and say, okay, you remember that time I did that Oscar Wilde movie? Well, this is not quite that far. But it's sort of like it. Same energy. And then we also had an owl post from Jerry via the website. And Jerry says, just listen to your second screenplay episode, 158. The comments about Fantastic Beasts merchandise reminded me of a lucky find I made this past weekend. I was at an event that focused on antique cars / trucks, but a vendor of signs happened to have a 2-foot in diameter metal sign with the magical Congress of the United States crest / symbol. Yeah, sounds kind of cool, right? The cool golden eagle or some other magical bird, and the US flag inspired bits with the words around the edge. And then it says, official licensed from Warner Brothers / Fantastic Beasts. So are they saying that this was officially licensed?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Okay.
Interesting.
We'll go with that until I have reason to think otherwise. It is so cool in large format like that. I counted the stars, and between the two different star locations, they had 48, which is the number of states in the U.S. at that time. And the stripes were 13, of course. It is so cool hanging on the wall next to my front door, and it was a bargain. I want to see the sign. Jerry, if you could email us, speakbeastie@gmail.com, and show us the sign, we'd love to see it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, Jerry does not have to disclose the price if they're not comfortable with that, but I wouldn't mind knowing if it was a bargain exactly how much something like that would go for. Is anyone else curious?
Yeah, I want to know.
Yeah. Sounds pretty cool.
Well, maybe if we're lucky, we'll have a nice piece of owl post with the sign in it for our next episode. But then Jerry goes on to say, the piece of Fantastic Beasts merchandise I want the most is a Loungefly Fantastic Beasts Kowalski Bakery mini backpack. Except I don't use backpacks. If they had that design as a t-shirt or poster, I would buy at once. The design is so cute. But then I already own a Picket and Teddy / Niffler and a lovely scarf with Frank the Thunderbird on it, and have assembled clothing to make a gender bender Newt costume for Halloween. Plus lots of HP stuff from over the years. Great podcast. Love your show.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks.
Aww.
Okay, Jerry is now my favorite person.
Yeah.
That backpack is adorable.
Super adorable. I want... you know what, Jerry, if you could just like send us pictures of all these wonderful I want to see where can I get a Frank the Thunderbird scarf? I love scarves.
Yeah.
Outerwear and winterwear are my favorite, and also Frank the Thunderbird, love him so much. These and gender bender Newt costume, come on. I love that sentence, a gender bender Newt costume for Halloween.
Basically, Jerry, we just want all the pics.
Yes, please be our friend, Jerry.
Pics didn't happen.
Unfortunately.
I won't believe you until I see images.
Accio peer pressure.
Oh, wow. I googled Thunderbird Fantasy Beasts scarf, and I found one, which is absolutely gorgeous. I don't know if it's that one that Jerry owned, but wow.
Oh, I think that's... I'm looking at the same one.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
See, I was going to look it up, but the last time I was on an episode and something was described to me that I looked up on Google Images, I found all kinds of things.
Oh,
what?
I'm going to leave that there so that we can get into our main discussion for today.
All right. So we are continuing our discussion, going through the screenplay and comparing what's in the script to what makes it on the screen. And today we are going to discuss scenes 15 through 19. So that starts off in Credence's room at Nirmengard. And it's during the day. So the description at the start of this scene is Credence's face comes into frame. He meets his own eyes in the glass, then raises a hand. As he watches, a fly crawls along his arm. He watches transfixed. Then his eyes shift. So this is one of those little differences between the script and the film. The scene opens on a close-up of his hands in the actual film. And he's scrubbing them. And that weird bit of him watching this fly and being transfixed is still there. A few thoughts I had about it was maybe it's signifying the lingering death on him.
Mm.
Like flies swarm when they know something's dying, right? And the Obscurus is slowly killing him. We know that by the end of this film. Not only is it inevitable that he's going to die, but he also just played a hand in the death of the Chilin as well.
Mm-hmm.
Out damn spot.
And I thought that's, the adding of scrubbing his hands, it might be that he feels soiled, or I don't know, by what he did to the Chilin.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it's such a sacred creature and... So,
But scrubbing your, when you didn't physically contribute to something like that, but you're scrubbing your hands because you feel like there's symbolic blood all over them, that feels like a very specific type of reaction that isn't that consistent with what we've seen from Credence.
Mm-hmm.
It just, the descriptive language in the screenplay just, it really, really makes you think about what the hands mean in the scene. So I figure either they are grasping at straws super hard in the screenplay, or I didn't pay close enough attention when I watched the movie. It just, I did not think about his hands or the fly or any of that other stuff that much when I was actually watching the movie. I think I was mainly just kind of focused on the fact that Ezra Miller was in the scene, and then the mirror kind of threw me off, and I just completely forgot that he even had hands, let alone what they were doing.
Can I just throw out there that we have, you know, obviously, like, because of Johnny Depp, basically, avoided talking about as much news related to actors, and Ezra Miller's life has been insane. But they are finally seeking mental health treatment, and I just want to say, thank God.
Yeah.
Like, I think we already knew Ezra Miller was probably not going to be in any more of these films, but just, like, I just, you know, we're all very happy about that.
Yeah.
I think everyone in the world is very happy about that.
Yeah.
I wish Credence sought mental health treatment.
I wish mental health treatment existed. I mean, never mind the fact that this is the Wizarding World and they don't have therapy, but this was the 30s, maybe. We don't know. We don't know.
The 30s, maybe.
We don't know.
You know what?
We do not know.
I think it is one really important thing that I think we haven't talked about not knowing the year is whether or not alcohol is legal in the U.S. And I think that would really affect... a lot of things.
Whether or not it's legal, it's present and people are doing it.
I know.
That's for dang sure.
You know, is Jacob having some nice drinks every once in a while? I don't know.
I'm sure he's having drinks. I do not think they are nice drinks.
Well, exactly. That's my question. Anyway.
I think they are the sad drinks because these two, the scenes we're talking about today are, they are such sad scenes that focus on the sad boys
this
and their sad lives.
This movie is truly just about sad men.
Yeah.
Yes, sad men with really sad men problems, and all of the women who show up are just so wonderful. You got Lally, you got Queenie, even, blanking on the name,
Bunty.
The What? No, not Bunty. No. Well, I do love Bunty. Bunty's fun, but no, the hench person for
Rosier?
Yes, thank you. Sorry. Forgot Rosier's name for a moment.
So anyway, original sad boy Credence. he looks up and he sees Queenie standing behind him in the mirror, and they have that little exchange about whether Grindelwald sends her to spy on him. She answers no, but he asks what you're thinking, what you're feeling. He says, and do you tell him? I should read this as it's written in the script. This is a little descriptor. The screenplay says, she starts to reply, then falters. As the veins in his hand lighten, returning to normal, Credence turns, looking at Queenie directly for the first time. What is up with the veins? Because this is the first time hearing about it. Were they supposed to be, like, dark before? Like, what?
Like, this dark magic that is festering or taking over, whatever it is, is now literally turning his blood colors, and it's showing up in his veins.
I would have liked to see that as a sign of what was happening to him, but no.
I feel like we didn't get a close enough shot of his arm to notice this.
Obviously, I don't. When we are recording, the DVD is not out yet. It's out tomorrow in France, so I don't own it. But so when he's scrubbing his hands, I guess it's normal hands. It's not because it would make the adding of scrubbing the hands more understandable if we can see that maybe the obscurus is visible just under the skin or something like that.
Right.
And he tried to, I don't know, to wash it like he could, like, yeah. But obviously he can't, and I don't know. But I thought it was something connected to the obscurus, obviously, but we don't see it on screen.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. And this is the first reference to it in the screenplay, too, that I saw.
Yeah, which is very weird that it doesn't say earlier, like, and his veins are dark. It's just like, and they lighten.
It's like, oh, okay. They were dark before? Sure.
He's got mood veins. They turn dark when he's sad and angry and brooding, but then when he starts to calm down a little bit, they lighten up and change colors.
Wow.
Makes sense.
It reminds me of The Witcher when he drinks the potion and his face transforms and we see black veins. It reminds me of that.
Oh. I didn't think of The Witcher, but that's a good point.
So Credence basically answers for Queenie because she's distracted apparently by his veins. and he says, yeah, you do tell him. And then he says, who's reading whose mind now? And she looks super uncomfortable, as you would. Does Credence actually know Legilimency, or is he like guessing and then like making this really uncomfortable joke?
I think Queenie just is just remarkably transparent for somebody who can actually hear what is inside other people's minds. I think she wears her emotions on her face and her sleeve, and she's also a very open and honest person in terms of the things that she says to people a lot of the time. She just, she conveys exactly what's inside her head so that nobody has to read it, which is interesting considering she's the Legilimens in all this.
Right.
I do think reading this conversation, it is just so weird. Like, I think in the movie, it's obviously still like a weird situation and like, but I don't know if, you know, directing and acting, it comes across more natural than reading it. And I'm like, you guys are so weird. Like, what is this conversation?
What a bunch of weirdos.
Yeah.
I definitely remember the first time I saw the scene, I was, whoa, that's a very weird interaction. And I wasn't expecting Credence to act like that with Queenie, but...
Yeah.
And Queenie looks so terrified and so uncomfortable.
She does.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's clearly scared of him. She's seen how powerful
he is.
She's
like, hey, Grindelwald just killed an animal, so I think I'm going to bounce. How do you feel about that?
Queenie looks uncomfortable until the last scene in the movie. Let's be honest. She's uncomfortable this whole time. She's usually a bright spot for me, but she spends like most of the second movie being really sad and scared and lost, and now in this movie she's just constantly walking on eggshells thinking, did I make the right choice? Of course I didn't. Can I get away? Probably not.
So Queenie basically like recaps back to Credence all the things that Grindelwald's told him about being a Dumbledore, about him needing Credence to kill Albus Dumbledore, blah blah blah. Credence then looks super unhappy and tells her to go away. She leaves and then basically tells him she doesn't always relay what he's thinking to Grindelwald. And then that's when we get the mirror writing.
Yes.
And the descriptor in the screenplay says, slowly, as if drawn by an invisible hand, letters begin to materialize on the surface of the glass. Forgive me.
And then Credence breathes on the mirror and writes, new mirror, who dis? Now, I wanted that as like an outtake. Like, there are no bloopers. I want the bloopers, and I want Ezra Miller to do that. Like, forgive me shows up, and he forgets what he's supposed to do, so he just starts writing with his finger, new mirror, who dis?
That's an episode title right there.
Seriously, that's this one. We should write that down.
All right.
But I thought one of the most telling descriptors in this scene is that Credence looks, quote, unsurprised, and then wipes the glass clean.
Yeah.
So clearly this has been happening before.
Yeah.
When, the number of unanswered questions. This mirror is so frustrating. When did he find out? How did he get it? Why are these two mirrors connected? What did they, what's the first thing you text to your illegitimate child? When you find out they have a magic mirror you can text with.
Right. And does he know that it's Aberforth? Who does he think it is?
Can they actually, like, are they not just communicating with words? Can they see each other in the mirrors, like the ones from the original books?
So many questions.
Yeah. We don't have any clear explanation, but I'm sticking with my headcanon that, Credence thinks he's talking to his brother, and Aberforth is just responding, forgive me, forgive me, and doesn't say to him that...
Well, I don't know if, Credence has responded at all, or if it's just Aberforth sending his cryptic forgive me's.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. But probably Credence knows that's a Dumbledore, so he thinks that's...
Yeah.
Either of my brother, maybe Albus or maybe Aberforth, I don't care because I don't accept their apologies. So.
Yeah.
Well, isn't Credence responding to the mirror in the Hogshead, though?
Later,
yes. I don't know if he's responded before that or not. I don't know.
No, guys, he starts off the movie by ghosting his dad. And then if he doesn't make it home or down that godforsaken flight of stairs, he'll be ghosting his dad for real. Because he'll be a ghost.
No, this is too much.
Thank you. Good night.
Oh my gosh. So one of the extras we get in this scene in the screenplay is this nice little costume sketch of Queenie's costume in this scene.
Yeah.
I love the sketches. We've talked before, I think, how some of the sketches look exactly like the actors as the characters, and some of them look more like idea sketches while they were still figuring out the costumes. But these sketches in the scenes we're talking about today look exactly like the actors. Like, this sketch looks like of Queenie looks exactly like Allison, and the one of Jacob that comes up in a few pages looks exactly like Dan.
Yeah. I guess when you're on the third movie, it's like you know who you're designing for at that point, so you probably have that person's features in mind when you're drawing. I love the sketches.
I admire anybody who can draw, period. Even people who do loose sketches. I can't draw stick people, but I also admire people who design and make costumes because I can't stitch two pieces of fabric together either.
But that's why I am still upset that they didn't credited the artist of the sketches.
I know.
Yeah.
Mm. Wait, were these not Colleen Atwood's sketches?
Well, it doesn't say. There is no credit.
I tend to assume, I mean, these might not even be like costume design sketches, I guess. I think I just assumed that the sketches were done by the designer who is making the costumes, so I assumed that these were Colleen Atwood's sketches. But surely somebody of her caliber, they would say if she had drawn these, wouldn't they?
Yeah, we don't have only costume design. We also have some concept art of some scenes, so and true. all of them looks quite the same from the same hand, so I guess it's the same artist who did all of the illustration for this the screenplay. That's why I'm quite confused. Is it really pictures that were produced for the production of the movie, or is it illustration that were made for the
book? I wondered that too.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't know.
Either way, they should credit the artist.
They should. Yeah, that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
So then we move away from Nurmengard and we end up at Kowalski's Bakery on the Lower East Side pre-dawn. This is scene 16. And in this scene, it's very, very short. We see Jacob opening the shutters on his bakery, and the screenplay describes him as, quote, a sad and lonely figure of Jacob Kowalski standing outside in the chill. He stares bleakly within.
How many words do you need to just drive home that this is a sad boy? You have battered, you have chill, you have sad, lonely, bleakly, just...
He's looking at a fly.
Staring at flies and shutters. All the sad boys.
It's like, we get it, things are going bad.
And they're still going bad when we get to the interior of the bakery. Just spoiler alert.
Oh, this is my favorite.
Yeah, I don't know. You sounded so sarcastic.
No, this is, no, I mean, I seriously, like, this moment that comes up in the next scene is one of my just, it is such an obvious metaphor for what is going on with him.
Mm-hmm. It is very good. So this is scene 17, and this and the next bit, the scene 18, is continuous, and scene 18 is in the back room, where scene 17 is kind of farther up in the bakery towards the front. And they're both very accurate from the screenplay to the film. How he opens up the door of the stove to make sure it's lit, he sweeps up, and the whole sequence with the wedding cake that has the groom laying face down in the icing.
Mm-hmm. Like, we get it.
Yeah, that's all translated very, like, shot by shot to screen. Then the front doorbell chimes, and he lays the groom down and walks away to go see who is there.
See, it's a small thing, but the fact that the groom is face down on the cake, and he picks it up, but then he puts it down, and it's all alone, and I just thought, okay, this is Dan being a great actor, because he doesn't, it's not like a thing he says or like what his face is doing, because a lot of times people think acting is all about like line delivery or emoting with your face, but no, it's these little things like he separates the two, and the groom is now all alone. It's like, this is him. Duh.
And kind of like out of the shot, out of the picture. The way the camera really focuses on the bride standing alone and you can't see the groom that's laying down, like just out of frame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So symbolic.
Yeah. Very good visual storytelling, because we have the same shot at the end of the movie with the same, I don't remember if it's exactly the same figure, but yeah, it's supposed to mirror each other. And this time they are both. Yeah. The cake, so.
Yeah, love it. So scene 19 is still the interior of Kowalski's bakery. Moments later, still at pre-dawn, and Jacob goes up front in the shop and starts to tell the customer we're closed, but he stops short because it's Queenie. And it looks exactly like the end of the first film, the same coat and hat, same hair, same positioning in the shop by the pastry counters. And she says, hi, sweetie.
The fact that it's exactly the same at the end of the first film, it's not on the screenplay, right? The screenplay just says that it's Queenie. So.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right. There's really not much direction in the script here. other than Jacob walks towards her. But Dan adds this kind of layer of confusion to the character and his facial expressions. Like, he knows this isn't really plausible and doesn't believe what he's seeing.
Yeah, good acting.
It's almost like he's delirious. Like, he's either been drinking a lot or he hasn't been sleeping. Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah.
It's sad.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it sad?
Is it a sad movie?
Okay, so just check. It's sad, right?
Yeah.
Just because they haven't made that clear with, like, the language they're using.
Completely.
Or, like, the hands metaphors.
Guys, I don't know how you feel about this scene, but I think it's kind of sad.
I mean, I guess you could make an argument for that if you really want to. Good luck.
I distinctly remember when I first saw the movie, when we were in this scene, I was thinking to myself, God, this movie, every single scene until then, I don't know how many minutes we are in this movie at this point, but every single scene is so depressing and sad. And finally, just after, it's not in this episode, but next time we have Lally, and it makes Lally's entrance that more a relief and beautiful and colorful, because God, this that's a lot.
It just makes the arrival of Lally Hicks that much more wonderful, and unfortunately we don't get to that scene today. But it just has so much more of an impact when it takes that sharp turn from Sad Town into Lallyville.
So Queenie says to him, honey, look at your bakery, it's like a ghost town. And that's kind of when you can see, like, not only is it closed with no customers, but the shelves are empty.
Yeah.
And we know that the magical world inspired him to begin with, and now he's removed from it and depressed, so he's sort of, like, stopped creating. And
that's such a mood, Jacob. I get it.
And then he answers, and it's so heartbreaking. Yeah, well, I missed you.
Oh.
Oh, Jacob.
And then he hugs the air.
Yeah.
Because at first they're hugging, but then she's not there.
That reveal is, like, the worst.
You know it's coming, but it hurts anyway.
God, imagine being Lally watching all this. Like, oh boy.
But she's not watching it, though, because she's not there 1 minute, and then the bus rolls by or whatever it is, and then boom, there she is, and she's looking at her book. She's setting up the distraction.
But
she could be watching it, and then she changes position. She's like, oh my god.
It's like, okay, we need to change the channel on this program, because we're turning the soap opera into a sitcom right now.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah, so after we get that angle and it's revealed he's not hugging Queenie, but hugging himself, the descriptor says, he opens his eyes, looks at his empty arms, sighs. Through the grimy front window, he catches sight of a shy-looking woman, in parentheses, Lally Hicks, sitting on the bus bench across the street.
Not how I would describe her. Even when she's not looking up and she's trying to set up the charade, I wouldn't say she looks shy.
No,
not at all.
We get a lot of sketches and extras in this scene. We have the sketch of Jacob in his costume.
His apron looks too short.
Yeah.
His tie looks too short. This I never really thought about this until just now, but his tie and his apron both look like they are just so oddly proportioned.
It's like they're really at his waist, not at his hips.
It's like a waist napkin. Like, it doesn't, and a proper apron for a baker shouldn't, it should cover, like, his whole torso, and should also, I think, be a little bit longer.
Yeah, like almost to the knees.
I feel like Tim Gunn analyzing the sketch. Like, I'm just gonna be blunt and honest, this apron is more like a napkin for his torso. It is not doing him any favors right now. I think you need to possibly make this longer. Just make it work, Jacob Kowalski.
Oh my god.
It's like Tim Gunn has just waltzed into our Skype call. Uncanny.
It's like he's here. I wish.
And then we get these little, like, price listing images for Kowalski's Bakery. It says, Kowalski Bakery, we make bread, pastries, cakes, and fancy confections. And then it lists off, like, prices from 2 cents each or 4 for 6 cents.
And I love that, like, a lot of these are, like, Polish names for these breads and pastries.
I know that that word is ponchkis only because I have seen that word spelled as somebody was saying it.
Yeah.
A lot of these other words, not even going to go for it.
The first one, piernik, I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, but that's gingerbread.
Mm. That's gingerbread's delicious. When was the last, these prices are blowing my mind though, because when was the last time you saw anything for 2 cents or a loaf of bread or something for five? When was, first of all, I can't remember the last time I saw something that was priced in cents that I actually wanted, let alone less than a nickel for a pastry.
Man, I'd be happy if these were dollar amounts.
Right?
Like, I'll take some pastries for $6.
If I go to Panera Bread right now, I can get a pastry for a 99 cents, but I have to buy an entree first.
Yeah. So you're dropping, like, $20.
Yeah. It's like, were these ever real prices? Has inflation gotten that incredible?
I looked at the inflation result, what would it be today. It's still very, very low. It's 38 cents.
Wow. Nope. She's just so nice.
They don't charge 38 so cents for anything
he's not
anymore.
Pricing his pastries high enough.
He's like the Bob's Burgers of pastries. He spends too much on ingredients. He doesn't charge enough. His family keeps ruining everything. Well, closest thing to a family he's got now.
Then we have like a little like receipt, and it gives us the address of the bakery, which is 443 Rivington Street, New York, which we already knew it was on Rivington Street, but I don't think we knew the number.
You get this really cute little logo with like a little, I mean, it's probably like a little alchemy in there.
It does look like an alchemy.
It's cute.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Aww. Love it. Fun fact about the price, I looked for the the breads and 5 cents a loaf, it would be approximately the price of a baguette in France. So there you go.
Okay.
How much is a baguette in France these days?
It's high now. It's around 1 euro, but usually it should be around 18 cents. 80 cents. Mm. Yeah.
I love how you asked that, Jeff, though. Like, how much is a baguette these days? It's been a while.
Well, you know what? If I ever happen to be in France and I fancy a baguette, I would like to know how much money I should bring, Shannon.
A fancy baguette would be 1 euro and 10 cents, maybe.
You walk into France with 1 euro and 10 cents. You're like, I came here for one thing.
I want a French baguette and I'm not leaving without it. And then it doesn't get through customs and I get detained.
I mean, basically all I ate when I was in France was bread, so.
Sure, why not? Bread is delicious.
And I was there for like 3 days.
Yeah, so that's it for our scenes that we're discussing this episode. We had a pretty good chunk there. This was a interesting
bit.
We're
gonna have a good chunk next time.
It ended up being a surprisingly upbeat episode for such sad scenes, but there's more sadness on the horizon.
Well, then the next episode will be even more upbeat because it's happier times.
Yeah. Well, shall we move to Nomad Movie Magic?
Yes,
we shall.
I love this segment.
Ladies and gentlemen, please find your seats. Nomad Movie Magic is about to begin.
This week, so Nomad Movie Magic, it's been a little while. This is where we talk about like someone who's worked on the films. So I'm going to talk about Bryn Court, who I got to see on a couple panels at LeakyCon. First of all, I think the most impressive thing about Bryn Court is that he has the website moviesculptor.com. Just that.
So
just
cool.
He got it. That's what he is. He's a movie sculptor and he has the website. So yes, he was a sculptor on all 8 Harry Potter films and at the theme parks and the first Fantastic Beasts. So he was on a few LeakyCon panels, but he had one panel where like he showed pictures and he really talked in depth about everything. So that's where most of this is coming from. But for some background, he began sculpting in 1987 and then kind of moved into the film industry. His father was also a sculptor. Other films he's worked on include Braveheart, The Fifth Element, The Mummy Returns, Sherlock Holmes 2, and The Dark Knight Rises. Lots of other ones too. I think a couple James Bonds.
Yeah, I just saw on the front page he has the Dark Knight statues from the end of Dark Knight, the last one.
Yeah.
That's an amazing statue. That's so cool.
Yes, so he is a sculptor. So he worked in the production design department under Stuart Craig as a lead sculptor. So he didn't do any like creature work. Basically, all of his work that appears in the films, like, is a statue. Some of his work includes the giant chess pieces in the first movie, the gargoyle in front of the headmaster's office, the riddle grave, which we'll talk more about in a minute, both versions of the Ministry of Magic statues, and the Whomping Willow. So most of the time it was, like, statues, but also sometimes kind of that nature stuff, like the Whomping Willow. And he worked in, like, Forbidden Forest scenes too. Actually, I didn't write this down, but one cool thing is for, I forget which movie he was talking about this exactly, but they probably did this on multiple movies where they had to spend a lot of time in the Forbidden Forest, is they would sculpt different like tree roots. I think this was the fifth movie where the forest was more like giant roots coming out of the ground and they kind of looked like giant hands. So they would sculpt the roots, and then when they had to move to a different part of the forest, it would be all the same roots. They would just rearrange them to make it keep looking different. So for the most part, Stuart Craig, like, designed everything. But Bryn Court still had a lot of creative input. The process of creating the sculptures would usually start with, like, you make a small maquette out of, like, clay, get those approved by Stuart Craig, and maybe the director, and then you would move on to the full pieces, which were, for the most part, made out of, like, foam. So we're not built to last. So, unfortunately, I mean, like, we asked about the maquettes, and he's like, yeah, none of those exist anymore. And so a lot of the, like, sculptures don't exist anymore. But what does exist is, you know, on display on the studio tour and stuff.
Yeah, it's crazy because on the studio tour, they have lots of paper maquettes, but they didn't get the clay maquette.
Well, probably. It's just amazing how much work went into making this stuff, and then, like, so much of it just got trashed.
Well, probably the clay, especially, you molded the maquette, and then it was like, yep, that's the design we want. You built the big one, and then you probably smashed down the maquette to use the clay again.
Yeah, yeah, I guess.
So one story he talked about a lot on his panel was the riddle grave, because this was really the only time that a director came in and was like, no, change it. So the original concept for the grave was inspired by a real grave in London. And I don't remember, like, what graveyard they said it was at, but it wasn't, you know, an exact recreation. It was just kind of, they saw this grave and were like, let's do something like that. Like, Stuart Craig and Bryn Court worked together on it. So we made this maquette. And a lot of these photos you can see on his website, too.
Yeah.
So you can kind of follow along.
Yeah.
You can organize by movie. So this would have been for Goblet of Fire.
With the angel on the stone, yeah?
Yes. So it's like this angel kind of draped over the front of the gravestone, has this really, like, flowing gown with wings over the grave behind her. And Mike Newell, the director of that movie, came in and was like, it's great. I want it to be darker. So then it became the literal Grim Reaper. Totally different direction. Grim Reaper with a scythe standing up next to the gravestone. And so that's obviously what we see in the movie.
Can you imagine going to a graveyard and seeing an enormous statue of a Grim Reaper over somebody's headstone? Just, I mean, I get it. This is Harry Potter land and bad guys look like bad guys and we have no subtlety here. I get it. But a Grim Reaper statue over somebody's headstone in a graveyard, really? I mean, is it just because the scythe has to hold him in place? Like, the angel arms aren't enough?
Yeah, even he was like, it seems like a bit much. but he did talk about seeing, like, the first cut of the movie that he got to see and how happy he was because the first shot of Goblet of Fire is, first of all, of the, like, skulls in a gate. So he made that, and then it pans, it follows Nagini over to the gravestone. And he was, like, so happy because that's really the most featured anything gets. You know, most of the sculptures he works on are in the background. Mm-hmm. But that was, like, starting the movie. And he was like, I was ready to walk out. I was like, I'm done.
Yeah, he even put a screenshot of the movie in the portfolio. Like, look at that.
So I think part of the reason Mike Newell wanted it changed was because what ultimately happens in the movie is the statue kind of comes to life and grabs Harry.
Yeah.
And so the way they did that was because it was made of very lightweight materials, they made two different versions of its arm that could detach and, like, snap back on. So they filmed until it needed to move, took the arm off, put the other arm on over Daniel Radcliffe, and then visual effects kind of filled in the movement. So I thought that was cool. My favorite thing that he showed, he did a whole segment on the panel about stuff that didn't make it in. There was a giant owl in the owlery in the fifth movie. Like, taller than... He has a picture of it next to him. It's taller than him, like, huge wingspan. And this owl was under the platform that Harry and Cho stand on. But it didn't make it into the movie. He was so mad because he's like, they filmed above it. But it's just this gorgeous giant statue. So you gotta go look at the pictures of that. He has pictures, for a lot of the statues, the sculptures, he has pictures of, like, the maquette, the kind of final sculpture, and then it, like, on set dressed up. So, but, you know, that's really a gorgeous piece that probably doesn't exist anymore. So then he helped Universal with all three versions of the Wizarding Worlds. So Orlando, Hollywood, and Japan, and then eventually Diagon Alley. And then he went to Fantastic Beasts, and then after Fantastic Beasts, and I think one or two other movies, he is now full-time with Universal Creative, working on the theme parks. So I'll circle back to Fantastic Beasts, but one sort of notable Wizarding World piece is the Hogwarts Gates. So this is at all three versions, where you have the winged boars on top. And these were cast from the exact same molds that were used to make the boars in the films. Because even molds don't usually survive. But those survived long enough for them to make them exactly the same in the theme park. So that's cool.
That's cool.
Very cool. I'm sure a lot of people probably notice and appreciate that.
Yeah. So then on Fantastic Beasts, he ended up having a lot more creative license than he did on the Harry Potter films, even though it's still Stuart Craig. But I guess by that point, Stuart Craig was like, you can do this. You got this. So he mostly worked on, I think he might have only worked on Makusa, because that's all that he talked about, which is a shame because so much of this stuff he don't see very well. So he created the Salem Witch Trials Memorial statue that's in the atrium. So you see it very briefly in the film. It was originally supposed to be like a relief on the walls going through the story of the Salem Witch Trials. But I can't remember if he said it was his idea or like Stuart Craig. Or at some point they decided it's going to be like a statue in the middle of the room instead of on the walls.
Kind of like the Fountain of Fair Fortune at the Ministry of Magic in Britain.
Yeah, which he made. Did. So what is ultimately the final version is these four adult figures in like a semicircle with a little child kind of holding onto a woman's arm. So he was inspired by the real story from the Salem Witch Trials of a woman and her daughter, her like infant daughter, who were both accused of witchcraft. Presumably Dorothy and Sarah Good, which Sarah
An
Good...
An infant accused of witchcraft?
Yes, Dorothy was 4 years old and briefly like spent time in jail, but thankfully was not put to death. Unfortunately, her mother was Sarah Good. But so he kind of was inspired by their story, but didn't like base it directly on them because he was trying to be very sensitive about this being like a real historical thing that happened. But that just was something he had read about and struck him so much, because that is a very sad story. So something he showed us, and you can see on the website, is he also sculpted like a judge figure that was to be part of the memorial, condemning the women. I think there's like three women and a man in the final statue, but they decided to not include the judge, presumably also because of sensitivity. They were like, that would be kind of really dark. Why would you have the evil person in the memorial? Another thing was Stuart Craig's original idea was that there would be eagle statues throughout Macusa. And Bryn Court was like, well, that's boring. Let's do phoenixes. So there are phoenixes on the tops of columns.
And there's like a person who identifies as a Ravenclaw with an earshot going, hey.
Hey. Well, they were like, what's American? Eagles. And then Bryn Court was like, but they're magical Americans. What's the magic eagle? And he also worked on their facade of the Woolworth Building, which they did not get to visit the real Woolworth Building. He did it all off pictures.
Wow.
And that's impressive.
I filmed some of his panel where he specifically talked about Fantastic Beasts, and that will go up on Patreon soon.
Ooh, were you allowed to film that?
I was allowed to film a little bit because I was media.
Oh, lovely.
So all the pictures are on his website to look at. But yeah, I filmed a little bit of him talking about this. One other thing, though, because I didn't film when he talked about what didn't make it in, but I posted about this on our common room, but there was one Macusa sculpture that didn't make it in that is just so interesting to me. It was this very creepy woman of death with her arm straight out to the side pointing, and it looked like she was draped completely in like wet cloth. And it was crafted from, it was molded from another crew member, which a lot of just the sculptures in general from Harry Potter were molded from other crew members. And so she was pointing to the death chamber in the first movie. And so in the script, in the original version of the whole kind of escape, Queenie holding the case was to hide behind this figure from Graves, which I just find so ominous for Queenie. Just for what we know of Queenie's story so far, that she was supposed to hide behind this figure of death.
Hmm. Yeah.
But it didn't make it in. But it's a very cool sculpture. And so, yeah, so now he works full-time at Universal Creative out of Orlando. And he said his favorite thing is to go and watch people get hit by the water that sprays from one of the interactive wand effects. So, yeah. So, you know, people asked, like, so what about the new park? And he was like, it's going to be epic. About Epic Universe. So we don't know anything about it, but he is working on it. So
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. This was really interesting.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. I'm really fascinated by this death statue from Macusa. Yeah.
It's so creepy looking.
Yeah, it reminds me of...
That's so interesting.
Yeah, because I studied history of art a few years ago, more than 10 years ago. But yeah, I remember some tomb from the Renaissance which had this type of figure, the veiled figure. And yeah, we had... I know there is one in the Louvre that I was really obsessed with because of this veiled effect on the face. I was really confused of how you can translate in stone this veiled face. Like it's...
Yeah.
That's really, really impressive. Again, for someone that is not an artist and doesn't know at all how to sculpt anything, so...
Well, and of course, Bryn was not working with stone.
Yeah.
I don't know what that figure I don't know what's easier, like, really. I don't know what that figure specifically was made out of, but...
Yeah, but it's not transparent. It's even if it's clay or foam or anything, they succeed to make it look like it's a transparent veil, but it's not.
Yeah, so, it's still very impressive. Yeah. And it is impressive how they made, like, all of these sculptures that were made out of foam and clay and stuff and made them look like real stone. Like, he worked on all of the, like, you know, suits of armor. They're all foam.
Wow.
It's like they don't look like foam.
Really is movie magic.
Yeah.
So our podcast question for this episode: which statue from the Fantastic Beasts films do you want to see in the new Epic Universe theme park? I want all of them.
Yes, really.
And why is it the death statue?
Yeah, of course. So we'd love to hear from you. So drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And you can also leave us a review on Apple Podcast. We will love a good review from you. So please.
And if you want to keep up with the show on all of our social medias, we can be found on Twitter and Instagram at SpeakBeastie. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/SpeakBeastie. We are on Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com. And you can support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/SpeakBeastie, like our amazing patron, Lucio. I'm calling them that until they specifically ask me not to. And you get all kinds of fun perks with that. You get cool stickers, and you have access to our exclusive Patreon bonus content, like the video that Shannon will be releasing very shortly.
Yes.
So that is going to do it for this episode of Speak Beastie. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jeff.
I'm Shannon.
I'm Marjolaine.
And I'm Amy. Case closed.